Hey, podcast folks. Good January to you. I'm not sure. Great program today. Just really fun. They Might Be Giants came to the studio today, to Studio A, which is where I usually do the show from. When we have bands, we usually go upstairs to Studio B, which is a performance studio, and there's glass that sort of separates me, the host, and the engineer from the performer. But we did it differently. This time we had Glenn Luttman engineering right in the same room with me, and so it's just very off the cuff and very relaxed, which was, I think, part of what made it so excellent this time. John Flansburg, John Linnell, and Marty Beller on the percussion, on the drums, really. He was playing an accordion case for a kick drum and a snare and a hi-hat, so interesting. Anyway, you can visit theymightbegiants.com or dialasong.com to get information about the band or their newly relaunched Dial a Song service. Don't forget, coming up in the next few weeks, I think next week is Steve Boone from The Loving Spoonful, whose book was excellent. I got a guy who wrote a book about Joan Jett coming up, and I have Will Birch, who wrote a book about pub rock, which was, both of those books were good. The pub rock book was amazing. So stay tuned. Go to wfmu.org/Michael for the archives or the list of upcoming stuff. John and Marty from They Might Be Giants. Just about an hour here talking and playing a bunch of songs. So stay tuned. Thanks for everything. Hope you're doing well. They Might Be Giants. There is They Might Be Giants, and they are here live in the studio. Good morning, John and John and Marty. How are you guys?
Hey, Michael Shelley. It is truly an honor to be on this radio program. I cannot tell you how much time I've spent listening to your... I listened to your podcast interviews where you excise some of the music, which I don't think you should bother doing, but I'm not speaking for your lawyers.
I've been told to, yeah. So,
yeah.
The man.
Yeah, but, you know, come on. The Christmas special had all sorts of recorded material.
Yes, it did. But as you noticed,
if I can say that in the public forum,
in the introduction to the Christmas podcast, I said I was cutting the music out because I didn't think the powers would be would listen to any more than the introduction.
Oh, so
and then I left all the music.
Maybe we should continue this conversation off air.
Ixnay and the music may.
Yeah,
it is not your guys' first time on WFMU. I don't think. I think it's probably your millionth time. I mean, many times over the many years. Yes,
we were on the Frank O'Toole show a lot in the very earliest days of the band,
and I remember 1985-ish kind of times.
Frank is still on the air here.
Yeah, I remember being extremely nervous about being on the radio when we were on the Frank O'Toole show.
Like, that surprises me. It was such a casual vibe.
It couldn't have been more. I mean, he was a total gent. There was nothing like uptight about it, but it was just the idea of being on the radio really made my head cave in at the time.
Wow. And here we are a million years later. I believe you guys met in school in Massachusetts at what grade?
I think John was in the 7th grade and I was in the 8th grade. I'm just going to guess. I don't quite remember. We didn't really become friends till high school, but we met probably
When did you move to Lincoln?
Oh, well, when I was 8.
Yeah, I mean, seven. I feel like I knew, you know the kids in your school, but you don't hang out with the kids who are a year different.
So right, it's right.
I'm sort of in the George Harrison position of, like, forever.
Whole year younger.
Yeah, that's right.
He's the young one.
You couldn't understand.
Right.
He's not sophisticated. He's a year younger. Wow. But, you know, things like that matter more when you're a kid.
Yeah. And when is the first time? Was it things that you had seen each other doing in school that made you think maybe this is...
We weren't musicians when we met. John was kind of he was interested in working for the school newspaper.
The Promethean.
I was the editor. Yeah. So that was, you know, there was an office where it was which was basically a social scene. It was not. We got no work done in the office. It was just a place to hang out.
And so that's where you. That's your first collaborator.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like
yeah.
it was actually a clique of people or a clique. What is the word? It was
either
a group, it was a group of friends
for radio.
That I think all really. You know, in the same way that any group of sort of like rowdy and sort of curious kids can influence one another in so many different ways, I think we kind of cooked up a lot of ideas as a group that still sort of it casts a really long shadow into what we do. I mean, in some ways, you know, I think you know John and I are. You know, we're in a duo together, and people think of us as like, you know, those two guys. Where did they get those ideas? But I feel like in many ways,
we stole them from our friends.
We stole them from Dan Spock and
the smarter people.
James McIntyre.
Glenn, can you give me more, just a little more total output from that thing?
Yep.
Is that possible?
Just to match my...
Sure.
That's right. You're naturally loud voice.
That's groovy.
Right.
We have to have artificial help.
We're talking to the overlord, Mr. Michael Shelley.
Exactly. I'm in the high chair. Because so many bands that I think the three of us like, and maybe Marty too, you can sort of look at them. They can look at the Beatles and see what records they listen to. It's not so easy with They Might Be Giants to listen to your records and think, what were these two guys listening to in high school? There's not a straight line.
I mean, if you wanted to be super blunt about it, you'd just be like, these are a bunch of guys who listened to Frank Zappa and then punk rock happened.
Well, and I suppose the other thing is we were listening to stuff against our will in high school, which probably eventually had some kind of influence.
Yeah, you know? I mean, sometimes you're responding to things and sometimes you're like responding against them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think like what really spoke to us about the new wave moment was the concision, and if that's not a word, I would like to trademark it, of songwriting, the return, like the pub, you know, the pub rock, the Nick Lowe, the Elvis Costello, and then the Ramones, in a sense, not the sonics of the Ramones, but the idea of like just having something be a really hard-hitting blast of really graphic music.
Yeah, in my high school there were a lot of bands, and most of them I remember going to high school dances, and bands would play White Room by Cream and Love Her Madly by Doors.
Right,
and that made me.
I don't want to talk about the Doors.
And those just because of the people and the it made me so know that that's not where I was headed in
right.
any direction, and not you know I don't know. No.
Although it's funny you cite those things, and now I think, well, I sort of feel like now that that's way in the past, there's something kind of. I smile when I hear White Room now. You know, like the lyrics. I love Jack Bruce's voice. You know, like
it's not. I'm not saying it's terrible.
Yeah,
just at the time, it was
at
so
the time
not
it was
new.
Oppressive. Yeah. It was killing us.
Right. It was very much in the way. I mean, I feel that way about. You know, it wasn't until kind of the smoke cleared and all the Led Zeppelin fans stopped punching me in the face that I realized how good a band Led Zeppelin was.
Yeah. Right.
But I feel like, you know, the tattoo on the knuckles of the guy punching me in the face said Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And it's hard to forgive.
Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you kind of conflate the two. You know, it's like Led Zeppelin equals bullying.
We had to, in humanities in high school, I had to give an oral report, and I gave mine on New Wave music and brought in a cassette recorder, and Tony Rust punched me in the face right afterwards.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah. So a literal example
yeah.
of being punched
for liking
based on your musical taste.
New Wave will get you punched
yeah.
in the face.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the sticker to put on the
so
Brothers.
So we heard this Dial-A-Song and the Dial-A-Song thing was... You both moved to New York City, I think, in the early 80s. And
yep. Yeah, 81, I think. Fall of 81 is when I came to go to Pratt as a student. I went to the foundation year at Pratt.
Which is a designing school?
It's an art school. It's just straight-up art school. It's like sort of art school bunk, you know. It's just like really hard art school. And John came to New York with
I was in
band.
A band, so we made the decision.
Just the Mundanes?
The Mundanes
Providence,
Rhode
Island.
And we were going to make it big, so we came to New York. And then I dropped out of the band pretty much right away.
Right. And my band opened for the Mundanes in 1981.
No way!
When I was 17
no
years
way.
Old.
No way, where was that?
At CBGB's.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah,
at CBGB's.
We were little
wow.
kids.
Yeah. Well,
what year was that?
1980.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't play that many times at CBGB, but. And they had a poster. The CBGB had a poster What was the name of your band?
We were called the Imposters at that time. We were little kids.
You might have been on
and
the...
And we used all
oh
your
Oh, my God.
All your
you were
equipment.
The little kids. We played with a band of little kids.
Yeah.
I remember this vividly. The girl was the oldest one. She was like 16.
Yeah.
And the rest of the band were like 12. I'm not kidding. The band was really...
There were some shorter
you.
Members of the band, yeah. And
I
so we go way
we not,
back.
Have we already had this conversation?
We did have it once, yeah.
Okay. I completely forgot it was
okay.
you. I forgot it was you.
But they were...
I'm looking at you, Michael, sort of mediating how much he should say
yeah.
or not say about this. Like, some of the band's members were shorter than others.
Well, it's not right to talk about myself.
They were... The band was like half prepubescent. I mean, that was... It
some
was
of the
really
members of the band were shorter than others.
It was remarkable. It was like we were... The mundanes were very impressed by the Imposters.
Well, you guys let us use all your equipment because we had brought these, like... You know,
right.
We had two amplifiers and seven people, and we would all plug into two amplifiers.
I'm so glad you reminded me, Michael, because that is a very fond memory. I mean, it's so anti-CBGB, too. Like, it was like, well, we're playing at CBGB with children.
Yeah, probably be some punks to spit on us. No.
Just to drill down in this sharing an amp thing, I remember in the very first band I was in, we shared an amp. The two guitar players. But the thing is, there was two sides to the amp, and one of them was distinctly louder than the other. So it was
whoever got there first.
It was a very contentious thing, like who will get the
lead
the powerful channel? Side.
Right.
Yeah, well, being a band is, in some ways this was the best band I was ever in, and we will stop talking about me soon.
No, I want to spend the rest of the
right.
show on this.
Because we would go to Isaac's basement and rehearse three times every week. You know, what band have I been in since then?
Not to carry on forever about this, but you guys were the mundanes exactly 10 years younger, I think.
Right,
I'm pretty
there were
sure.
Seven
well,
people
there were six people. The girl was the oldest. We had a girl singer who was 26,
wow.
I think, and yours was 16, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was one of the youngest, and the keyboard player in your band, I think, was 12 or something. I'm not
played
joking.
A farfisa. Yeah, it was funny. Well,
it's
because
so
we were just like Blondie, which I think you guys were too a little bit.
We were a bit like Blondie, and you guys were... We were like 10 years younger than Blondie, I think.
So you've been in the band a super long time together.
Yeah, it's strange. It's strange for us for other reasons, just because it is, you know...
Did you ever come close to breaking up?
You know, I want to say, like, there was ever a point, but we actually have never had any kind of radical, you know... I mean, I suppose you could say there was a point in the 90s where we should have broken up, you know, where like, in the mid-90s, where we got dropped from Elektra and we were losing money, like, every year.
That's amazing.
And
we were in this weird sort of vicious cycle where we were broke, and the only way we could make money was by touring, but the thing, ultimately, touring was not really profitable. So, like, touring would bring money in, money would come through, but it didn't really keep us in the black.
Partly that's a testament because you guys tour with good lights and good sound and cannons and, you know,
it's always a fun, good show.
I've seen you guys many, many times, and it's always an experience, and anything can happen. And the anything can happen feeling is often missing in rock and roll, you know. And I think
rock and roll in general is...
It's not what you usually go out to see. It's like anything might happen. It's sort of like, well, I want to hear the dependable hits by the band I love.
White Room.
White Room. And
right.
That is interesting, isn't it? That's exactly what people are paying a lot of money for, to be validated.
Right.
For knowing.
Well, different audiences want different things. And, you know, some people certainly go pretty far underestimating the, you know, how curious their audiences are. We shared a tour bus with a band that, I mean, they seem extremely, you know, dinosaur-like to us, but they're probably only, you know, 10 years beyond us. But we have been told by crew members that we share with them that they have not changed their set list in, like, 20-something years.
Wow.
Which seems, it seems like a prison sentence to me. I mean,
but it's also not inviting repeat viewing that much.
Yeah, exactly.
Except that they figure, like, anybody who's there to see them just wants to see that anyway.
And, you know, I mean, there are... I've had that experience of going out just hoping a band would play the same songs, you know. So it's not that crazy.
I don't know. Like, if I see Elvis Costello do, you know, radio again, I'm going to kill him. You know, it's just like, I'm so bored with that. Yeah, I think
you're making a public announcement.
Are you Elvis?
Right.
I know he's listening.
Well, that's like an interesting thing, because Elvis Costello, we opened for Elvis Costello.
I was there.
For like a week at
Radio City Music Hall or Beacon, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sure many of your listeners who hate They Might Be Giants are just listening to this interview going like, I endured those guys at the Beacon watching Elvis Costello. And what was interesting is that he was doing this thing where he was playing all the songs off his next album, which to me seemed very, Elvis Costello changed my life. Like, I'm his not only his number one fan, I am his first fan. You know, I actually saw his first public performance in London, and it really was a mind blower. But it seemed like it's sort of brought up the question of, like, is that just shaking the audience off? You know, there's sort of another side to it. Like, it's one thing to be super conservative about what you play, but it's something else to...
But if I had my druthers, I'd want to hear everyone do their new songs. Maybe rather than their old songs. Even if it's somebody I love and I don't like their new songs, I'd still rather hear some of the new songs.
See, I feel like those Live Nation booking agents would heartily disagree with you as they, like, contractually oblige Roxy Music to play, you know, four songs from Avalon in every show.
You guys play live a real lot, real consistently. Mm-hmm. The most shows you ever played in 1 year, how many?
The one we toured
last year, I think.
No.
Oh, Flood. I guess Flood.
Flood was the biggest year.
Yeah. Most.
Flood was like the. I think we probably played like 250 shows. Wow.
And you're not afraid of doing in stores and doing radio things.
No, we let
a day
that stuff
is packed.
Is fun, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. That stuff is fun. Here we are. So, okay, opening act. You guys luckily don't have to be the opening
act. Best time opening act, Michael Shelley.
That's right.
Yeah. No, you guys as an opening act, besides Elvis Costello, ever have a terrible experience? Ever get treated
We probably shouldn't even talk about it.
You don't have to mention the person.
The main thing is, and I'm sure you can relate to this, we've played opening for bands where the audience was utterly unsympathetic and angry that we were not getting off quicker.
You're just 35 minutes between them and the person they love the best in the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's
so
hard.
That became probably the more typical experience for us, that we sort of felt like opening is a drag, and whoever were, you know, excited person in the middle row or introducing to ourselves, it doesn't make up for the demoralizing experience of everyone else hating us.
I'll give you like a very odd example. We opened for a huge act that was actually playing in arenas, and because we were relatively unknown in a lot of the places we were going, we thought we better have like a really, you know, a really full show to just, you know, hit everybody super hard with like our 25-minute set. And so we brought a couple of horn players on, and it was, you know, for real expense, like, you know, bringing on horn players on tour is like the opposite of free. And immediately the headlining band was like, hey, we were wondering, like, could we have your horn players play on a few songs just, you know, because they're here and be fun? And of course the horn players, who are complete, you know, itinerant musician professionals who want to find every gig they can find, are like, yeah, we'd love to sit in with you guys. And it just put us in this awkward situation where all of a sudden
we're like subsidizing the headliner.
You know, these guys are making millions of dollars. We're getting paid. We are actually getting paid $250 a night to carry a semi and a tour bus and seven musicians instead of five.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those conversations, one of the negotiations where you're just, there's no being the cool guy. You know, like, you just don't even know what to, like, any way you slice it. Like, the horn players are going to hate you. The band's going to hate you. You're going to hate yourself.
Well, you hope it pays off somewhere down the line. Horn players are also, let's not get into horn players too much. You guys are doing monthly shows in Brooklyn every single month this year. This changes the tour itinerary a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. We're playing the last Sunday of every month, and it's a different show. We basically spotlight some idea or an album to make every show kind of different for the people coming back. But the first bunch of shows are sold out, which is exciting, and Yeah, it'll be an interesting thing. I mean, I feel like there's a great tradition of New York bands doing New York stands. You know, there's something cool about...
And they'll all be sold out. It's going to be so much fun.
I hope so, yeah.
That'd be nice. I mean, we are changing every show. We'll you know, that's, you know, speaking of not playing, we'll be, the first set, we'll be playing White Room.
Mm-hmm. Then all Allman Brothers.
Yes.
Right.
But I guess we have a tradition of doing this kind of thing where we do a themed show at every night of a stand.
Well, you have 16, 17 studio records. There's a lot to choose from.
We don't know most of those songs. As you've learned today, we don't actually know our material. So we have to learn it. So that's a lot of work.
When you made your first record, was there any idea you'd still be doing this a million years later? Here we are.
We knew exactly what would happen.
Yeah, yeah.
We knew we'd be here today.
That makes it easy.
It's this week there have been all these articles coming out about the Dial Song service just because it started up again this week. And there's this constant thread in this current set of articles, which is, and I don't know how this started, which was that we started Dial-A-Song because we were trying to get the attention of major labels, and
right.
I just want to say that were a good idea.
That's usually what works.
I just want to say for the record, no one starts a project in 1983 to accomplish something in 1990. You know, it's like that would be like kind of blah-ha-ha, kind of master
Dr.
plan.
Dr. Evil, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's just, and it kind of confounds me, although the truth is, it is something, that statement is something that Bob Dylan said on his radio show about us. It's the only thing Bob Dylan has ever said about us in a public forum.
They make giants.
And, yeah, it's like, you know, they'd started this thing and to get a label deal. Oh. And it just is such a sort of a UFO that's passed over our world, but it's been put into the echo chamber everywhere, and I do want to remind people that would be a very weird idea.
It's funny. I did look on Wikipedia before. Read over
your. Made some corrections.
Well, I thought it was one of the things I wrote it down. Quote that you are commonly referred to by the nicknames Flans or Flansy.
That is a fact.
It's just like so ridiculous.
That's, you know, well, that's Wikipedia.
Thank you very much. You know, will you play some music for us?
Sure.
Yes. What do you got?
We got a song from our first album.
We've got three songs for you here.
All right. They might be giants, folks.
There's only two songs in me, and I just wrote the third. Don't know where I got the inspiration or how I wrote the words. Spent my whole life just digging up my music's shallow grave for the two songs in me and the third one I just made. A rich man once told me, hey, life's a funny thing. A poor man once told me that I can't afford to speak. Now I'm in the middle like a bird without a beak, 'cause there's just two songs in me and I just wrote the third. Don't know where I got the inspiration or how I wrote the words. Spend my whole life just digging up my music's shallow grave for the two songs in me and the third one I just made. So I went to the president and I asked, what's his name? Has he ever gotten writer's block or something like the same? He just started talking like he was on TV. If there's just two songs in you, boy, what do you want from me? So I bought myself some denim pants and a silver guitar, but I politely told the ladies, you'll still have to call me sir, 'cause I have to keep my self-respect. I'll never be a star, since there's just two songs in me, and this is number three.
Number three.
And here's another song we like to play. It's called Dr. Warm. Marty Beller, will you count it off?
One, two, three, four.
They call me Dr. Worm. Good morning, how are you? I'm Dr. Worm. I'm interested in things. I'm not a real doctor, but I am a real worm. I am an actual worm. I live like a worm. I like to play the drums. I think I'm getting good, but I can handle criticism. I'll show you what I know, and you can tell me if you think I'm getting better on the drum. I'll leave the front unlocked, 'cause I can hear the door.
So one of the things that we discovered about new songs is that when we play them for the first time, they're often too fast. And this song is exceptionally slow. This song is actually going to be the song of the week next Tuesday on the Dial a Song service.
So we've already written the song for next week. that'll be the second one in the year.
Excuse me.
So we've got 50 more. To write and
it's
record.
Like the Matrix. Somehow,
it's just like the Matrix. That is the catch-all phrase of things that are impossible to explain. It's like the Matrix.
It's like Inception, actually.
Right.
It's okay. A lot like Inception.
So, Marty, what is the actual tempo on this song? I need to
77
BPM for people who are doing the live remix at home. Set your DJ
right. Key of E.
Yeah.
77 BPM.
Okay, here we go. Hold on. I should introduce this song. This song is celebrates the unreliable narrator in songwriting, and it's called "Madam, I Challenge You to a Duel."
There it is.
The sound of two hands, four hands clapping. There's They Might Be Giants playing a brand new song, probably never been heard in the world yet.
No. We have yet to play it correctly.
The tempo was there. Don't blame Marty.
Yeah, no, the tempo, Marty held us back.
Marty was fine.
Was there a time when the accordion was in Albatross, or has it always been awesome?
Well, in the sense that it's a very heavy thing around my neck.
I meant it both ways.
Yeah. It has always been an albatross.
Did your parents? I mean, I'm seeing parents forcing someone to play.
No, I didn't pick up. I didn't have an accordion until John and I started doing this, and we started out with I had a clavinet, I think, and then
Where's somebody that
we knew had an accordion. She loaned it to us. And
clavinet is the keyboard that Stevie Wonder plays on.
That's right, Terry Adams.
Superstition.
Stevie Wonder.
The rubber band sounding. Where's your clavinet?
It's in our studio. It's set up there.
It was in storage for about 15 years.
Yeah, the best.
Truthfully, we haven't used it. It actually had mouse skeletons in it.
Yeah.
When the guy came to like fix it up, and there were actual mouse
skeletons.
They had
eaten all the wires.
That is amazing.
And then made a little house.
And then died.
The door got
the
closed.
The mouse graveyard.
Let's talk about the creative They Might Be Giants thing. You both write songs. I take it 93% of the songs are written alone with no input.
That
from
is
the
that's
the
lights probably off. A pretty good percentage.
It's sort of, we've done
more collaborating probably recently than for the bulk of the time we've been working together. We've come up with various ways to.
Are there rules about vetoing?
I think the angry scowl is the tell. Yeah, exactly.
You learn.
How could you bring shame upon our band with what you have brought forth?
Mouse skeletons. Each of you tell me why the other guy is so good.
Ooh. This could be embarrassing.
Well, Linnell can start.
This is embarrassing. Flans is a great lyricist. I want to tell you, he has only gotten better in the last... Are we blushing? Is this the weirdest confrontation we've ever had.
Wow.
I am a strong admirer of John. I wish I could write lyrics as good as John's.
Wow.
Tough act to follow.
Yeah, top that, man. Yeah. What do you say about me?
John's a super sweet guy.
Linnell takes showers. He doesn't smell too bad.
John has been like a tremendous like influence over me in this way that's only been positive. I remember years ago, John saying, like, you know, we were talking about songwriting, and there's like a. I remember hearing an interview with Elvis Costello where he was talking about how Nick Lowe taught him that there was like a trick to it. And I think what he meant was that like the little details, like the extra bits, like on that last song, for instance, it goes like, "Madam, I challenge you to a duel, to be careful, that bit can be unrung." That little like chord substitution right there is actually kind of the trick. And I think what Elvis Costello was saying is that Nick Lowe kind of hipped him to like adding in. It could have just cycled to 1/4/5 and just be like a rock and roll Dumbo Wumbo song. But adding that little bit of extra stuff, although it might seem like Tin Pan Alley stuff, is actually a big part of what makes a great song. And I always remember that. But then we were talking about, John and I were like in a van ride, you know, across Montana for 48 hours. And we were talking about songwriting. And John just said, like, you know, I think it's just as important to surprise people with your songwriting as it is to, like, do, you know, actually just write something that seems to be in good taste. And, like, that, I think about that all the time. Like, I mean, I have to say, like, of all, you know, if I had, like, a little embroidered pillow next to my, you know, desk, it would be, like, surprise people. It's such a practical, important thing to know, and I don't think John.
I don't remember saying.
I don't think John was like giving me like a life lesson. I think he was. Just
that was Danny Weinkauf.
But we were just having like, you know, open ended conversation about stuff, you know, and I think, you know, the the influence, like the positive influence of just being in a really active collaboration is pretty heavy. Like, it's hard not to be in that gravitational pull.
It's really hard to surprise one another, obviously. That's
right.
That's
no surprises there. just disappointment.
Heard that coming.
Oh, that one.
Cliche number. Right. Is there, do you develop you guys are going on tour in April, and you go through many different, starting in April, many different parts of the United States.
Yep.
And you've been doing this for years and years. See, you know, through different presidents and different governors, mm-hmm. and speed limits and marijuana laws and, you know, everything. Do you get a second sense where you walk into a venue you've never been into before? You can look at the PA and figure out what night of the week it is and what kind of a crowd is going to show up and what you, can you get.
Well,
that?
The Sleater-Kinney reunion has pushed us out of the couple of regular venues that we play in Portland and Seattle, we actually often play at the same places, and there is this strange kind of familiarity. I think for a lot of people, it actually, I think for people who are worried about their career, it's, you know, there comes a point where you're thinking, like, I'm just doing the same stuff. Like, how come I can't get out of this, you know, dungeon of rock that I'm in? But I feel like, you know, for us, it's like, you know, we are very acclimated to the dungeon of rock. You know,
yeah, it's
like
I think it's the level of commercial success is not how we, in other words, we're trying to keep reinventing the project. We do play in a lot of the same places over and over again for 25 years or however long it's been.
You know what the fruit
but that's like. That's just the background. That's just the setting.
Is it true 3 million records? Is that about right total?
I mean, Flood alone has sold well over a million records, so I would imagine
a lot of records.
A lot of them were to the same guy, though.
Yeah.
A lot of landfill.
Yeah.
Your fans are particularly devoted to you.
There's definitely a front row.
Some people.
There's definitely a front row there, so they might be trying to Wikipedia that we can almost reference for tax purposes at this point. You know, it's like it knows where we are so much of the time. It's incredibly comprehensive, and you know, has set. It's great for me putting set lists together because they list the set of every town, every show we've ever done, like all the way back to the 80s. So I can look at the last couple when we're playing in Portland in April or May. I can look at the show we did in Portland a couple of years ago and the one a couple of years before that very easily and kind of confabulate a completely different experience and really give people just sort of without much effort at all. We can kind of create a more original show than we ever would if we didn't have that resource. So there's a very positive part to being
saying there was anything
tracked.
Negative about, but I mean,
oh, I can tell you the negative.
I assume it's there's some double edge. People feel they own you, or they deserve more. Because
you know, it's funny. I think we were 20 years ago, probably much more creeped out at the at the increasing number of people who were like kind of a little bit fanatical, and now I sort of feel like. They're actually the funny thing is like the old ones are old like us, you know, they're just part of the landscape, you know, and it's great. I mean, obviously the people who run the wiki, we are deeply indebted to those people, you know, it's incredibly
work.
Useful. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we enjoy a different kind of super fan than some people do. I think, you know, for a lot of people, super fans really feel like stalkers.
Yeah, and at one point we did have
stalkers.
Seriously super crazy people. I mean,
why?
To have died
why
down.
You guys?
Well, I think
it
turns
MTV,
out it turns out just, that, you know, that everybody does. I think, yeah. You know, we
it's
have...
It's not they think Dr. Worm is them or,
is about
you know.
Them. Yeah. Why did you write that song about me?
You know what you were saying.
Yeah.
Somebody was saying that basically if you're an actress on any sitcom, will have not just one stalker, you'll have multiple stalkers. I mean, that's the culture we live in.
Yeah, we're in the middle range of... We just... have one at least at you're a time, not female. Basically, if that, you know. But then there are like a Bob Dylan, I think, probably has an entire, you know.
Bob Dylan has a security staff that is simply dedicated that's to
what
tracking
for, yeah.
the mental state of his, you know, continuous.
You guys knew each other stature. Before you knew your spouses. Did,
yes,
that's true.
Did your practice in your close relationship inform your spousal relationships?
Wow.
I don't know how to interpret that question.
I don't know if my wife is listening to this
program. Why don't
program.
You guys play some more music?
Here's
a song from the last.
Here's all They Might Be Giants.
I'm
going to
be
folks.
Thinking about that question of this whole song.
All right. One, two, three. Lost my mind, left somewhere behind. Must have put it in amongst the things for throwing out. Nowhere to be found, buried underground. But try to dig it up, but I don't want to wait.
Here's a song we like to do. It's called Cyclops Rock.
Gosh, you had a Cyclops Rock, and then you go turn around and break my heart and waste my Cyclops time and mess up my Cyclops mind. I'm sick like Nixon was sick. My defeated heart keeps beating on. I won't die like Chucky won't die, but I'm not here to socialize. Gotta find a new place to hang out, 'cause I'm tired of living in hell. I'm a mess since you cut me out, but Chucky's arm keeps me company. I'm a fright with my tombstone smile. All the children run away from me. Gotta find new friends to hang with, 'cause you're all afraid of me. And I taught you how to Cyclops rock, and then you go and turn around and break my heart and waste my Cyclops time and mess up my Cyclops mind. John! Sean!
It was sweet, like lead paint is sweet, but the after effect left me paralyzed. I just stare with my one glass eye, hoping you won't be back again. There's a whole new generation waiting to be wrecked by you. And I taught you how to Cyclops rock, and then you go and turn around and break my heart, and waste my Cyclops time, and mess up my Cyclops mind. I taught you how to Cyclops rock, and then you go and turn around and break my heart, and waste my Cyclops time, and mess up my Cyclops mind.
Wow.
Ooh, no, as the bicyclists on the streets of New York City say, no brakes. So here's a song. What's the name of your daughter, Michael?
Juniper.
That's a great name. Here we go. You thought of that name? Okay.
You made that name up?
He wrote this.
All right, so this song is called The Alpha, 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 Alpha,
Algeria, Bulgaria, Cambodia, Dominica, Egypt, France, the Gambia, Hungary, Iran, Japan, Kazakhstan, Libya, and Mongolia, Norway, Oman, Pakistan, Qatar, Russia, Suriname, Turkey, Uruguay, Vietnam, West Xylophone, Yemen, Zimbabwe. Egypt,
France,
the Gambia,
Hungary,
Iran, Kazakhstan,
Libya,
and Mongolia,
Norway,
Oman,
Pakistan,
Qatar,
Russia,
Suriname,
Turkey,
Uruguay,
Vietnam,
West Xylophone,
Yemen,
Zimbabwe,
Azerbaijan, Bolivia, Canada, Australia, Belgium, Chad, Afghanistan, Brunei, China, Denmark, Ecuador, Fiji, Guatemala.
Russia, Suriname, Turkey, Uruguay, Vietnam, West Xylophone, Yemen, Zimbabwe.
Ah, that is a number one hit song.
That's
great.
We don't want to make it sound like the record. Why would we want to do that?
It was great. I should say that Glenn Luttman is mixing the sound today, and
thank you, Glenn.
You're welcome.
Had the voices panned just slightly like this, and it was very effective.
Yeah. That is the
for
key
the remixers.
A number one hit song, apparently.
I think
one of
it
the
is.
Secrets.
Absolutely is. They Might Be Giants are our guest in this studio right now. They're playing monthly at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, the last Sunday of every month, and every
That's
week
right.
a brand new song over at dialasong.com. For free. They're going to make it up in volume, I suppose.
We will not be playing weekly. We'll be playing
yes, you will.
Formally.
We'll be playing monthly.
You will not be playing the Cialis theme music.
You guys have been on many television shows. Have you ever been on a television show where there was an awesome other guest on the show?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. We were on the Conan show with Chris Rock. Which is
he's great. He's funny.
Yeah, and
we're on Joe Franklin with Paul Sorvino.
Yeah, yeah. I heard your ID with the Joe Franklin thing.
I interviewed Joe Franklin once. It was so great and bizarre.
Well, now how did that go? Was it hard to interview Joe Franklin? I would imagine it could be kind of tricky. Did you break through the preset?
No.
Yeah.
It was easy to do. I mean, I loved him. I was prepared. Right. And it's on his terms, though, obviously.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's as all things Joe Franklin are, I think.
Because show business.
But he did the best IDs for me ever. You know, that was so much more important to him than the interview. You know, let me get all the pertinent facts, and then he works every one of them in, you know, and with more adjectives than you knew. And the guy's got a thesaurus.
He's a beautiful man. He's introduced us on stage a few times, and the way he does it
what does that cost you?
Really great. You have to pay for the car service.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
Send a nice car.
Yeah, but he was super sweet.
That's lovely.
Yeah. But, we did the Joe Franklin Show a lot back in the day, and I mean, there were so many different guests.
We were on with Bernie Wayne, the writer of Blue Velvet and Viva Las Vegas. He was a songwriter.
And you got to sit on the couch the whole time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, not only that, but he would insist that you talk to everybody
right.
else. And that was the whole deal right. with Joe Franklin.
Right. Like, John Flansburgh.
What do you think of the song Blue Velvet?
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic song.
Well, they're great. Bernie Wayne came out and played Blue Velvet, and he without telling us, he took some of our stage outfits. We had these golden fezes that we'd brought to the Joe Franklin Show, and Bernie Wayne took one and wore it during the song.
Wow.
He understood the spirit of the Joe Franklin Show. The other thing about the Joe Franklin Show that's super weird was that the set was like a lot of television shows. They basically used the two sides of the soundstage for their two main sets. And so when the cameras are pointed in one direction, it's the Joe Franklin Show. And when it's pointed in the other direction, it's Romper Room. So you're staring the entire time sitting on the couch for 60 or 90 minutes or whatever purgatory length time that was. You're staring at the Romper Room set, like the full, like, Doobie, you know, 9 foot tall, paper mache.
I don't know if Romper Room's gone
Doobie.
Now, I imagine.
I think it is gone. Yeah, the glass and the, I see John and I see John.
Right, yeah.
It was a show that we grew up with. Still going, Channel 9, New Jersey.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You guys started as a duo, just the two of you guys, and added a band at a certain point, and Marty is here now. When you guys make a song now, and Dan and Dan and Marty have put their two cents on it, what percent better does it become because of those three guys?
I don't think that there's numbers.
Zero?
There are no numbers to express it.
As long as they do what we ask them to, everything's fine.
It's unquantifiable?
You know, sometimes it gives us a lot. It's an incredible sort of buffer for us, because we can sometimes cook up a very strange, simple idea that we don't know how to flesh out at all, and bring it to those guys, and they'll figure out a way to make it sound sort of legit. In other cases, you know, the demos will be very complete, and we'll have a very clear idea of how we want it to go. So it kind of lets us work a lot of different ways. I think, you know, one of the things people are always saying, like, you guys write so many songs, you're so prolific and everything. And I think one of the reasons that we can sort of figure out how to cook up so many things is that we don't have just one set way of doing it, but we do have a great team of people that can help us, like, realize what we're doing in a way that sounds full-blooded.
Well, the other thing is that they kind of, at this point, you know, Marty was the last member to join, and that was in...
He's the baby of the group.
That was in, I don't know, 14 years ago or something. Is there a problem?
No, I think the red needs to face you.
Oh, okay, all right. Here we go.
Oh, so now you're on the radio.
Okay. Should we go back and play those songs again?
So where did you meet? In high school?
Yes.
What fame level are you guys?
That's sort of a mystery to us. You know, I'm always surprised when I'm recognized, but
is there an app that will tell us?
I think we're probably like around a 3.
Out of 18?
Out of a 10.
Out of a 10.
My next door neighbor just asked me if I was a professional musician.
Yeah.
And I was like, and, you know, I mean,
it's probably like, you know, we're really famous amongst the people who know who we are, and we are complete unknowns if people, I mean, my cleaning lady discovered a copy of Keyboard magazine with my picture on the cover,
And she was like, "What? What
John.
Is this? What's going on here?" Yeah,
right. Yeah. But you have a cleaning lady. This is, yeah. This tells us more than.
Well, I can afford a cleaning lady. That's how famous we are. Yeah. Yes.
And we can afford parking spaces. We have parking spaces.
Oh, that is a
a certain level of fame.
That's true. Although we're parking for free today at FMU, I noticed.
You think it's free, but
right?
It's free to go in.
Right.
Right.
Have it's you seen? It's pledge drive every time you try to leave right. the WFMU parking lot.
But you get a T-shirt for parking. People stand up at shows and hold cell phones and film you and take pictures of you. That's something that's changed. It drives me crazy as an audience member.
Mm-hmm.
It's just distracting more than and I just
yeah I agree. It's stupid, but it's very hard to shame people who are on a mission to make their perfect bootleg. And it's just it's a no win.
It can be such a huge percentage sometimes. I mean,
I feel like the whole thing of like as iPads get larger, or some of those things, that to me seems like a bad trend. You know, when you see the person holding an object that could actually block the vision of more than one person behind them.
That's true. If they just had Google Glasses, then it'd be easy.
But I don't know. You kind of have to give up on trying to control the. I feel like there's something equally, devilicious about trying to control everyone's behavior at a show. You know, I mean, there's a great YouTube video of Axl Rose basically wearing the outfit of what was that movie? He's wearing like a feather boa and like a motorcycle cap. He's basically the Midnight something or other is the movie from the 70s. He's like clearly art directed outfit, and he's just like freaking out at somebody taking his photograph in the audience. And it just, you know, there's a stadium full of people, and the only thing that's happening is that this guy in a feather boa and a motorcycle cap and like a thong is yelling at somebody taking a photograph of him. It's like, seems clearly right. ready to be photographed.
No, he wants privacy.
Right. Can we get a little dignity here on this stage?
Have you seen Birdman and Boyhood?
I saw Birdman, and I give it, 1,000 thumbs up. It's a fantastic movie.
Thumbs down.
We
really?
did not like it. Because
Marty just went,
This interview is over.
Right.
It's not the first time.
We can play as a duo.
Okay, why do you like it?
We only have a few minutes left. Ultimately, just boring. You know, just not.
I haven't seen it yet, so I'm. I saw Boyhood, which was. No. Well, you
thumbs
don't like anything.
On Boyhead. Oh, I didn't realize we
you don't like
we
anything,
were in the presence
apparently.
Of a misanthrope.
Yeah. Not at all.
Boyhood, I thought, was great. I super duper enjoyed it.
The best defense I can have of Birdman is that it's not like any other movie.
Yes, but I totally agree. But
it does that thing. You're like, one thing that for people who haven't seen Birdman, it's a all one shot movie, which is like a gimmick, and you kind of go like, it's not quite that.
It does. There are point of view cuts in between.
But basically, it's like there's a real gimmick to the way it's shot, and yet it also has special effects in it.
Style
and I feel
over
like,
substance.
All right, should we play a song here?
I love style over substance.
We talked about how prolific you guys are. There is a lot of output, and every week you now have to put out a song. There is no scaredness about this.
No breaks.
No breaks, baby. I guess you're giving it away for free at dialthesong.com.
So what do people expect?
Right. What did you want?
Right, you got what you paid for. Nothing.
Move along. Yeah. They Might Be Giants are live here. They're playing monthly shows at the Music Hall of Williamsburg. Which is the next one that's not sold out?
There are 100 tickets left for the February show. We're actually playing our entire first album live in February.
Wow.
And Jonathan Colton is opening that show. And then in April, we are playing songs from Dial Song, which will have had, at that point, have 16 songs.
Folks can go to theymightbegiants.com for all the dates you're playing starting in April-ish, all around the USA, and dialasong.com to subscribe to the Dial Song. What song are you going to play us right this
minute?
This
is called Can't Keep Johnny Down from our Nyajma Halama album of several years ago. Here we go.
Outnumbered a million to one, all of the dicks in this dick town can't keep Johnny down. Man piled up in a towering mound, none of them once has found a way to keep Johnny. lies are not a monument to justice, plus which I don't forget a face. And they can't keep Johnny down. Haven't yet built the man that'll keep old Johnny down. Some dude hitting golf balls on the moon, bathroom in his pants, and he thinks he's better than me. I'm pointing a finger in my own face. They can't know what's in here, and they can't keep Johnny down. Beneath my dignity to flip off the guy when he pulls up alongside to say my gas cap is unscrewed. And they can't keep Johnny down. They haven't yet built the man that'll keep old Johnny down. And they don't know what I've seen. They haven't their guts in here, and they can't keep Johnny down.
One of the greatest things about having a radio show is you get to have your favorite bands on and get to talk to musicians you love, and it's been so fun. This has been great. I could do another hour so easily of this.
We love that.
But Rex is coming up next, and
right.
he doesn't like you guys much. Thanks to Glenn for engineering. Glenn Luttman, great job. Marty Beller on the drums back here.
Marty,
John Flansburg,
Glenn.
John Linnell. TheyMightBeGiants.com is the place for your They Might Be Giants shopping and info, and dial a song to subscribe. Next week, Steve Boone from The Lovin' Spoonful.
Whoa!
Yeah, one of my favorites. And his book is great. Oh, hey, Rex, I guess I need your first cut.
I get the feeling you've been cheated.
I remind you, you're tuned here to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org.